I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City's landscape is in the middle of a makeover. Along with the new office tower downtown, there's talk about a potential high-tech project that could connect 18th and Vine to the Crossroads District. Today, the multiple development projects going on in Kansas City. From downtown to the Crossroads to the Plaza, a bunch of plans made in 2018 are coming to life in the new year, and we'll get an update on how the skyline is changing. Then, government employees went back to work this week, and they still haven't seen a paycheck. Three area organizations will tell us the effects they've seen from the shutdown and how they've been helping federal workers. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The surge continues in downtown Kansas City. More specifically, it's the building boom surge, and on the way are lots of new apartment buildings, new hotel projects, and a 25-story office development that ranks as what could be the first multi-tenant office building built downtown since the early 1990s. So much is going on that we thought we'd bring in Kevin Collison once again, editor-in-chief of the online news site City Scene KC. Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
In 3 years, how different is downtown Kansas City going to look from where we are today?
Oh, well, 3 years from now, probably the biggest change is going to be the opening of the new Lowe's Convention Center Hotel. That's supposed to be finished in the spring of 2020.
Right. That's being built just adjacent to the Kauffman Center.
The other day, City Manager Troy Schulte told some folks at a downtowners luncheon that they're adding a floor a week to this building. So it's going up quickly now. I was at the luncheon of the downtown council last week, and they've completed the framework for the skywalk that's going to connect Bartle Hall with the new hotel. So yeah, it's definitely moving quickly. We should see a couple of major apartment projects completed within 3 years. One is over in the East Crossroads area, which is the first new residential development going on in that part of town over at 20th and Oak. The City Club Apartments, where the old Hereford House used to be, if people remember that, and the Midwest Hotel. That's about a 300-unit apartment project at about 20th and Main. The new Stockyards, or I guess they call it the Yards apartment project down on the West Bottoms, a couple of hundred apartments, first new construction down there in many, many years is going to be done. And there may be the framework or a possible near completion of that office building you mentioned to me. I'm not quite sure what exactly their groundbreaking date is, but that could be completed within 3 years. And again, as you mentioned, it's the first new spec office building done downtown in a long time.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment, but that's above the Joseph Bank store,
right,
just at 13th and Main, roughly.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Right?
When they built the Power and Light District, that block was always designed to have a second an office building built on top of it. The speculation early when they did it was that H&R Block would do a second tower there. H&R Block is part of the development group that's pursuing this project. But yeah, they built the structure and the foundation strongly enough on that retail block that this will be right on top of the block where the Yard House is and Joseph A. Banks, right.
As you were describing these new buildings, you were using the word apartment quite a bit.
Right.
Is that because the apartment inventory downtown is virtually fully occupied and there's demand for a whole lot more?
Well, it's a great question. The banks are still lending, so people out there who actually put real money on the table believe that the demand is still there. I think, from last I heard, we've got occupancy rates that are still around 90%. Some projects are doing better than others, depending on the location and how newly opened they are. But we'd probably have, just off the top of my head, at least another 1,000 apartments in the pipeline right now, in addition to all that's been opening up in the past year or two.
And so the skyline continues to evolve. And if you sit up on Children's Mercy Hospital's lot and you look north toward downtown, 3 years from now,
right,
it will continue to fill in and look very different.
Yeah, and actually, I forgot to mention Three Light, the third luxury tower that Cornish wants to build as part of their whole deal, should be finished in 3 years. So, no, it's definitely – we're not seeing any mega buildings going up. I mean, I know – A lot of folks would love to see something on the order of One Kansas City Place, which currently is the city's downtown's tallest building at about 45 stories. None of these buildings are going to be like that. They're not going to like become some new landmark spire, but it is filling in and making downtown a much more vertical place. But what's also really encouraging is a lot of new street activity going on. There's just been so many new little brew pubs and restaurants and bookstores, the kinds of things that make a city actually a lot of fun. I mean, it's one thing to look and say, oh, what a beautiful skyline, and then drive on the streets and there's nobody on the sidewalks because right. There's nothing for anybody to do. But we're really seeing more and more of that kind of infill, first floor, ground level stuff that makes it fun to come downtown and actually kick around for a day.
Kevin Collison of City Scene KC is my guest. Tell us a little more about this new downtown office project, because what's interesting to me about it is the proposal is to build this thing without leases signed ahead of time. This is, I guess, in the business is called a spec
speculative
building.
Speculative, right.
Speculative. Mm-hmm. So why is that happening?
Here's the, the biggest example. Last year, Starbucks wanted to open up a back office operation, and they really liked downtown. It would have employed 1,000 people. I think they were talking about 100,000 square feet. But there was just not any space available. Somebody could say, sure, we'll build a building for you, but they were on a much more quick timetable. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks have said, we're missing opportunities. We don't have substantial office space, new Class A office space, that's one of the terminologies they use in office construction,
yeah,
available to take advantage of opportunities when a big company like that is looking for space on a relatively short notice. So they ended up going to Atlanta, where there's office buildings going up every other month, it seems, and of course Atlanta is a much larger metropolitan area than Kansas City. And so that's the whole idea, is like we need to get some good office space, significant office space, so when somebody like a Starbucks comes knocking on the door next time and really wants to be in downtown Kansas City, we can say, look, we can get this ready for you quickly and meet your needs.
This is a John Copagan project, right?
This particular project is a Copagan, it's a Ron Jury, and H&R Block does have a part in it because they do control the development rights to that site.
And it looks like, based on what I saw on your site, it's a pretty attractive-looking building.
It's all in the eye of the beholder. I think
right.
It's a good-looking building. It does incorporate several floors of parking beneath it, much less than what ordinarily would have been the case, because a lot of people are starting to see the streetcar as a real amenity that's helping reduce the demand for parking. Really, when you're walking down the sidewalk, you'll be looking up at this thing, but the street scene will be the same, because again, the Joseph Banks and the Yard House and those places are going to still be there. You'll get into it through a separate entrance up into the tower itself.
Do you see the possibility for other office buildings being built down there, given the fact that this one is underway?
Well, there's another project that also calls for about 100,000 square feet of office space. This building that they're talking about in the Power and Light District is 250,000, but this outfit Platform Ventures wants to take the block across from Barney Ellis Plaza, and they want to build an office building and garage there, and they also want to renovate the old Kansas City Club into a boutique hotel and the upper floors of the old Muehlbach Hotel into apartments. So you got, so that would be a fairly significant. And then you've got a smaller office building that's right next to Corrigan Station that's now well under construction. It should be done, I think, next year. It's not that big, but it's definitely filling in yet another parking lot and making downtown a more dense and vibrant place.
The other thing I can't quite get over, Kevin, is just the number of new hotels that have been built or are being built. I mean, you just wonder how the city housed anybody 10 years ago, because so many new units have come online here that inventory has just doubled, tripled? I don't know what it's done.
Easily. I mean, between the convention hotel that's 800 rooms and all the other projects right now that are either recently completed or in the works, we're talking about another 2,500 of hotel rooms coming online downtown in the next year or two. And it's interesting you bring that up, because I did have a nice conversation with the new head of Visit KC, Jason Fulvey, I believe his name is. He came in from Pittsburgh several months ago, and he was saying, they've got a big, big job ahead of them, because they got to bring in the conventions and the tourism that's going to fill all these hotel rooms. And he use the word saturate. He thinks, you know, if we do everything that's going on right now, the market will be saturated. And all but
is
said
that a bad thing?
Well, you know, he's got a job to fill those rooms. It's not a bad thing because for many years, the rap on Kansas City was we just didn't have enough hotel rooms to get something like the Republican National Convention that you remember we were competing for a couple of years ago.
But I think we do now, don't we?
Well, we should. When this is all done, I think we will be in the competition with places like Indianapolis and Louisville that have been taking some of the business from us over the years. But he's basically saying, let's hit the pause button after all this stuff because, mm-hmm. you know, we really just need to concentrate then on filling these places. And his big push, and this came up again last week when Alan Tisch, I believe, the head of Lowe's, said, you know, we need to step up our marketing game for Visit KC. They need to beef up their budget a bit because, you know, they really have to go out there now and bring in the convention business that's going to fill these rooms rather than, you know, seeing everybody cannibalize one another.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Again, we're talking downtown development with Kevin Collison of City Scene KC. What else is happening with the Barney Ellis Plaza? You hear different things over time. Is that going to be there 3 or 4 years from now?
Well, there's a pressing need to repair that garage. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is starting to get in pretty bad shape. Everybody agrees. The underground garage there. Mm-hmm. Which, to be honest with you, most people probably don't even know it's there.
Hate that garage. Hate it. Always have hated it.
Yeah, yeah. But so there was a real ambitious series of studies that the Urban Land Institute did last year about how we could make Barney Ellis Plaza a more attractive place that people want to go. I'm not quite sure where any of those studies will go, but they definitely came up with some ideas because right now it's a pretty barren space.
Yeah.
It's pretty much just concrete and there's not a lot of things that, and it's elevated above street level. So people really don't know it's
don't go there.
They're not coming from the corner over there by the Marriott. So now whether some of those plans ever see the light of day, I'm not sure, but I know the city realizes that something has to be done to shore up and repair that garage if it's going to be around for another 20, 30 years. So somebody's going to spend some serious money there. What the timetable is, I'm not sure.
Now, you mentioned Troy Schulte, the city manager, gave a presentation to a downtown group just a few weeks ago. One item of conversation which will have a lot of interest is the downtown baseball park.
Right.
Those conversations continue.
There are
Where do we stand?
Well, right now there's a working group of private business folks who I'm not really quite sure who all is involved. I know a few of the people who have been quietly studying, trying to put together a convincing case to the Royals that it would be in their interest to come downtown. And so the big question is, it is going to take some, you know, several years to put the land together for building a ballpark and then actually building it. And the Royals lease expires around 2031, I believe, 2031 or 32.
That seems like a long time.
It seems like a long time to you and me, and it is. But if you are trying to put together enough land to build a ballpark, you've got to start working now. And that's what Troy said. He said one of the sites that had been discussed for a potential ballpark at 13th and Grand is already off, you know, off the table because development has taken over there.
13th and Grand. Let me think about
that. That's where the Traders on Grand building is, which has now been converted into an apartment building. Apparently there was a – and it would have been right next door to the Sprint Center, and there had been an idea. All this stuff is conceptual right now of doing the ballpark there. The sites
you
that
don't,
I've,
you don't need a lot of space for a
you
ballpark.
Only need,
which is
I think
surprising.
Just a couple of blocks.
Yeah.
You know, 14 acres seems to be a number that pops into my head. I mean, you and I think you've gone up to the new ballpark in downtown Minneapolis,
yes.
And that was wedged into a pretty tight location.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't need the huge space that you need for a football stadium. But you still need to have some substantial land, and you need to make sure it's got good access because you'll have a lot of people coming and going to the games. But the key thing is they need to get some sign from the Royals whether they're interested in doing this. Because nobody's going
to Dan Glass,
whoever, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, you're not going to have anybody seriously go out there and buy land and land bank it if the Royals and 3 or 4 years are going to say, no, we want to build a new ballpark out here where we are right now. Because make no mistake, people say, well, we don't want to build another new ballpark. I guarantee you the Royals are not going to want to have another a Kauffman 3.0. They're going to want a completely new ballpark out there. So me, giving you my opinion here. If we're going to spend a bunch of public money on building a new ballpark, let's put it in a place where we can leverage it and make other things happen, like we've seen in other cities.
Bars
like Denver
and restaurants
and
around the stadiums, what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, certainly someone would have spoken to David Glass by now and gotten some indication if he's interested or not.
From what Troy said, the Royals are definitely paying attention. They're listening. They are certainly not telling these people that are doing this right now, you're going after a dead end here. But I don't think they've also gotten to the point yet where they said, yes, if you build it, we will come. Or if you identify a site, we'll be a part of this thing.
There's also talk about decking the freeway that Troy Schulte talked about in his talk. What's that about, Kevin?
Well,
remind us what that is.
Well, it's okay. The South Loop, downtown was basically, they put a noose around it in the early 60s when they built the freeway system. And it really cut off the Central Business District from the Crossroads area, from the River Market, from the east side, from the west side. It was all part of that 1960s mentality that, better life through freeways, I guess.
Yeah.
So, it's a trench right now that separates the Central Business District from the Crossroads. About 10 years ago, people started floating the idea of putting a deck over it. And they've done this in places like Seattle, and they've done it in Dallas, where they take this freeway that is a barrier and they put a deck over it, a park on top of it. And suddenly what had been a big obstacle becomes an amenity. And the price tag, though, a while ago was pretty high. It was over $200 million. Well, now they've done some new studies, kind of trimmed it down a little bit, come up with some ways to save some money. So now we're getting to around $130 million. That's a lot of money, but still, considering how much it would do to help improve land values on both sides of the South Loop, plus the fact that at some point, MoDOT's going to have to replace those bridges anyway. So rather than spend money on just replacing the bridges, let's put it towards a larger, more attractive amenity for downtown. So there are, again, a working group of folks who have an interest in this because, for example, Cordish has, they have two light, which is right on top of that freeway, and three light's going to be right on top of that freeway. And you've got some other folks who would like to develop property along there, and it would be so much better. So they are engaged as part of this conversation. But it's still, you got a state of Missouri that is just trying to, they're broke when it comes to infrastructure stuff. And so it's pretty hard sell to try to get them to kick in. But, people are working on it.
We're talking downtown Kansas City with Kevin Collison. We have him for a few more minutes. If you have a question for Kevin, you can tweet us at KCUR UpToDate or give us a quick shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. What else is on Troy Schulte's downtown wish list? Anything else come to mind?
Oh, gosh, this between the decking the highway and the downtown ballpark. He basically it wasn't really so much a wish list. Those are a couple of wish list items. But he was basically telling the group what you and I have been talking about, all the new apartment developments, what's happening with these proposals for office buildings. Troy, he's survived now for a couple of different councils, and he seems to be, a majority of the council believe in him. But he also has a lot of other needs in the city. And of course, you're well aware of the whole conversation that's starting to really become a big issue coming up in the mayoral election. It's like, what about affordable housing, which is a big topic? And also, how do we get some of this juju going east into the east side? There's been some major investments on Troost. Part of that, and I guess actually much of that in my mind, is because there's been such a huge investment at Hospital Hill.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned seeing downtown from Hospital Hill, but you look back at Hospital Hill, you got Children's putting up a massive 9-story research building. You got Truman through its university health system building new medical office buildings. So you're really seeing a major, and UMKC obviously has invested heavily in their medical healthcare professional.
Right.
UMKC actually built a dormitory on Troost for healthcare students. So there's a lot of money being invested around Hospital Hill, a lot of it on Troost, and hopefully that'll continue to push the ripple outward towards more. And then everybody wants to get the 18th and Vine area going again.
I want to ask you about
proposals
that
there along 18th Street to try to make that a much more dynamic corridor.
James emailed us this, Kevin. Are these new apartment buildings, hotels, mixed-use space, etc., still being offered tax abatement incentives to build downtown? Seems like this was very common a handful of years ago, but is it still necessary to attract developers? How could Kansas City benefit from the additional tax revenue?
There is definitely still incentives being offered to build much of this. The hotel thing, is you're starting to see some real pushback on that front. People are saying, hey, look, you know, we've got a lot of hotels going on. Do we really need to continue to incent? You know, they have been successfully implementing some of the reforms that City Hall enacted a year or two ago. Folks aren't getting that automatic 25-year abatement at 100%, 50% anymore. You know, but you're still definitely incentives are very much a part of what we're seeing. But there is definitely some conversation. Drury Hotel, for example, wanted to build a hotel over by the Jackson County Courthouse. They wanted to tear down the Board of Ed. They made a request for incentives. They thought they needed to make it work. The city said, nah, we think you can do with this. And Drury said, no, we're not going to build. So we're definitely seeing a little tension going on now on that frontier.
Getting phone calls about the downtown baseball stadium. Steve from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, without mass transportation, where will people park if we build a downtown stadium?
Well, obviously, the parking would have to be a part of it. There is a lot. Studies show that oftentimes, particularly at night, there's a lot of surplus parking. A lot of those garages are pretty empty. And so, you know, you could certainly go towards identifying where those spaces are that would be available for evening games and weekend games. You know, other than that, there probably would have to be some parking. Again, the streetcar has proven to be a great amenity in that you could park, for example, up at Union Station at the garage there, or you could park down on the riverfront if they can extend it down there and hop on the streetcar and go to the ballpark. So there's a lot of new ways to approach it. And, you know, and that's also one of the subtopics are the Royals have become very reliant on the parking revenues they get out there. And that would be something that they'd have to figure out. Okay, you're not, you know, probably not going to be able to get the kind of money you collect
$12, $15 a car, whatever it is,
but, you know, for all that surface parking. So it's definitely part of the discussion that has to go on, but there's some new twists, and there's a lot more parking downtown than people actually think.
Another caller wanted to know who would pay for the new stadium.
Well, you know, we're getting way ahead of the game here, but in almost every American city, I don't care where, from New York to Kansas City, the public is going to be involved somehow or another. I can't think of a major league sports facility that's been built totally with private dollars.
The Royals would have some.
Well, the Royals would put some skin in the game, kind of like, I know they've got some skin in the game out at Kauffman, but, you know, it's a tough issue. But you know, right now, believe me, the politician who says we're not going to use any taxpayer monies to help build it, but then they lose the team to some other city, usually they get their scalp taken because they lost the team.
You mentioned some developments sort of between the basic downtown and 18th and Vine along 18th Street there. There's talk here about this high-tech project that could help connect the Jazz District to the Crossroads District. It's an education, research, and entrepreneurial center. What is that?
Well, it's called the Keystone Innovation District, and they announced it, the supporters announced it last fall, and the press release was heavy on very esoteric language about all the wonderful things it could do to help make Kansas City more competitive for research, et cetera, entrepreneurs. But there wasn't a lot of specifics about where, who's going to pay for it, what is it going to make up, who's going to be behind it. And so finally, a week or two ago, the KCATA, the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority, they've got a block at 18th and Truce, which is basically empty land. They signed a pre-development agreement with the backers of this Keystone Innovation District to give them 6 months to figure out, will this thing really work? And J.E. Dunn is involved. The Civic Council is involved. An organization called KC Rising is involved. So, and the Chamber and the KCADC. I mean, all these major organizations here in town that their mission is to try to promote the well-being and economic viability of our area are supporting this thing. And so they've got 6 months now to figure out whether this thing can actually happen. And BNIM Architecture did a preliminary drawing of what the campus might look like. So at least we have something that we can sink our teeth into that here's a location, here's the game plan for trying to see if this thing can work, and here's a picture of what it might look like.
And the idea is to sort of bring the Jazz District, it would sort help, of incorporate it into the larger scheme of the crossroads in downtown.
There's definitely a strategic goal by a lot of people to connect the investment and activity going on in the East Crossroads area with all the investment that's gone on at 18th and Vine. Now, that's, you know, it's a pretty long – it's not outrageously long. It's about five or six blocks, but you go
It's a stretch.
It's a stretch. And, you know, and but if continuing trends go, and this Keystone thing would be a real Keystone, for lack of a better word, for linking all the areas. But there's other good things going on, too.
Let's go to Al from Kansas City, Missouri. Al, you're on Up to Date with Kevin Collison. Good morning.
Good morning. Caught me in a bite here.
it's lunchtime, Al.
Really important show, but the really important part that isn't being addressed that I see anyway, and I just wanted to know how there can be a mandatory element in this development for helping the homeless in Kansas City, which we have about 2,600 homeless people. And developing the blighted areas. I'm seeing a lot of middle-class development that you're discussing, but I'm not seeing anything to resolve our social problems and
okay,
homelessness.
Let me get a reaction here from Kevin. Al, thanks.
Well, Al, I mean, those are some pretty heavy-duty socioeconomic issues that have been dogging Kansas City for a long before downtown started to show some life again. There are efforts to try to create set-asides within some of these apartment projects so that a certain percentage would be for affordable housing. There is, as we just talked about, a lot of money that's been invested at 18th and Vine, which is supposedly trying to help bring economic investment into that part of town. And Troost is definitely seeing some new apartment projects going up. Again, some of those, I know the project that Mac Properties wants to do at Armour and Troost will have a 10% discount for public employees like teachers and police and firefighters. You know, but to expect downtown to solve some of these heavy-duty issues you're talking about, that's a pretty big ask. And one thing that I always ask is people love to beat up on downtown and why are we doing this downtown and why aren't we solving these other problems? And the suburbs get a pass. I mean, nobody's pushing folks in Johnson County to provide more affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And there are many social services, and the downtown council is heavily involved in trying to take care or address at least some of the needs of the homeless.
Okay, Kevin Collison from City Scene KC. Kevin, thanks for the great update.
Oh, this was
always
fun.
Appreciate you coming in.
Great time. Thanks.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about life for federal government employees. The hardships continue. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, a conversation with Blue Springs Mayor Carson Ross and barbershop owner James Price. They spoke about living as African Americans in a city that is steadily becoming more integrated. You can hear what they had to say at kcur.org/uptodate. Well, the government shutdown is over for now, but has life gone back to normal for government workers? If you guess no, you're probably right. Now a conversation with three organizations about how the shutdown is still affecting government workers. With us, Marcy Nielsen oversees government affairs for the Government Employees Health Association. Marcy, nice to see you. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Sarah Biles is the Director of Communications for Harvesters. Sarah, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Dion Christensen is the President, CEO of the Mazuma Credit Union. Dion, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Well, let's go one by one here and tell us about what your organization has been doing to help federal government workers of late. Marcy, let me start with you.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, what's going on?
Well, as folks may know, GEHA, the Government Employee Healthcare Association, is a large employer in the Kansas City area. We provide health insurance and dental insurance benefits to federal employees. Mm-hmm. We've got about 1,200 employees, but in terms of members that we provide benefits to in the Kansas City area, we've got about 9,000 individuals who are without a paycheck because of this shutdown.
And what impact is that having on them, not having a paycheck? And how is that linked to their healthcare needs?
Yeah, it's a source of tremendous stress, as you might imagine. We are happy to tell your listeners that GEHA continues to provide medical benefits regardless of the shutdown. But there is always a concern about dental benefits, and we've been in a position up to now to continue to provide dental benefits. Mm. But we're really worried about their overall health and wellness, and the anxiety, the insecurity, the concern about being able to pay their bills, their concern about even being able to put food on the table leads us to have the dialogue this morning.
Because healthcare is something you're going to put off if you're not sure about your income stream going forward. Right? That goes without saying.
That's absolutely.
You're going to skip a doctor's appointment and what else you need.
You are. And we want to assure folks, federal employees who are either furloughed or who are having to go without pay, that their benefits are in place. We are providing the same health insurance they had before. Nothing is impacted in terms of their medical coverage as a result of this shutdown. But we feel like we need to do more. And so we are partnering with Harvesters, putting together opportunities to get food for federal employees who have been furloughed or who are out of work for the time being, get them access to a food bank now. Hmm. And although it is true that the president has reopened the government for the next 3 weeks, folks still have needs right now.
Yeah.
Because they haven't received their back pay
their
yet.
Paycheck. Yeah.
That's right. And lots of folks, whether they're federal employees or not, live paycheck to paycheck. It's just after the holidays. Lots of folks have bills that they have due. So we feel like it's a really important thing for us to be partnering with communities in the Kansas City area and organizations that want to provide support to those federal employees.
You know, speaking of Harvesters, Sarah Biles, what's been going on in terms of what services you guys have tried to accomplish here?
Well, as soon as we saw the shutdown go, you know, past a couple of weeks and people started missing that first paycheck, we anticipated that people would start calling our network of agencies, our food pantries and kitchens.
Did they?
And they did start calling. And then, of course, last week when they missed that second paycheck, we wanted to be ready to respond. And fortunately, GEHA stepped up and called us and said they wanted to help. And so we thought it would be best to try to add some specific food distributions that would target people impacted by the shutdown. These included the federal employees directly, any contractors who probably won't be getting that back pay. So we started those yesterday. Last night, we served 200 households showed up at our distribution last night. Huh. So we'll be having those the rest of this week.
And you've opened up distribution centers that aren't normally distribution centers, sort of temporary places where people can come and get some help.
We identified places last night. We had one downtown that was near the IRS center where we knew thousands of workers work there. So we've tried to put them in locations where people are either close to their workplaces or they're familiar with. We were going to have one tonight at the Pipe Fitters Union, but that one, unfortunately, we've decided to cancel because of the severe weather.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want our volunteers having to be out there because these are outside, but we will continue them tomorrow through Saturday.
You know, I can't help but ask, you know, a lot of the people who have been impacted here are people who have had long careers, have been getting steady paychecks. Showing up at a food bank has got to be really hard for some of these people. Just when it comes to pride, as anybody would probably
right.
feel.
Right. We yeah. find that normally with any of the people that we serve, but particularly last night, when people were lined up in their cars to get this food assistance. And while they were so very grateful to get that, they were very humbled and very embarrassed that they had to be there when they know they had a good paying job and they've been working hard.
And maybe some of them were a little angry, too.
Some of them were angry and upset, and you know, some people were almost in tears about the situation. So, I mean, we were glad that we were able to be there to provide some assistance because, you know, it probably is going to be at least the end of this week before many of them get paid, and they've got to catch up from not having a paycheck for more than a month.
Then they're staring in the face of the possibility of another shutdown a few weeks from now.
Right.
It might be going on. Well, Dion Christensen, again, you're with the Mazuma Credit Union. How have you guys pitched in here?
So Mazuma was started in 1948 by the federal government employees,
really because we want to make Kansas City a better place to live, work, and bank. So some of these situations provide kind of that perfect opportunity for us to connect a little bit deeper with our members. We have 64,000 members throughout all of the Kansas City communities.
64,000?
64,000. So yeah. We have 11 branches scattered throughout all of the communities. What this has done is it's provided an opportunity, again, for us to kind of establish a deeper connection with our members who are really, really kind of going through their own unique situation. Every single person has different needs, their own unique story. So we have a 0% no-fee loan program for furloughed workers.
0%?
0%. We have done about 250 of those loans since the shutdown began.
Is there a cap on how much money someone can get under that program?
The way it works is we look at the amount of the direct deposit that has last come in from the federal government, and we will give the loan based on that amount just to continue to kind of help them keep some sort of continuity through this time. Where again, there isn't any loan fees, there's no interest that we're charging. We're just trying to extend kind of that continuity to our members.
Again, I can't help but just wonder, how frustrated are some of your members that they have to reach out to you for that kind of help?
We've actually seen more appreciation and kind of gratitude. Of course, members are scared. They're uncertain. There's a lot of fear with the unknown. But that, again, has given us the opportunity to kind of find out how can we best help them, not only through this temporary situation that they're going through with either a loan extension. If they have a loan that they can't pay during this time, we will. Mm-hmm. We've done about 150 loan extensions and then the furloughed loans, and then just evaluating their entire financial situation. As Marcy kind of mentioned, a lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck, very good paying, long tenured government employees, but it's just kind of the nature of the society that we live in today.
I'm just curious about what kind of stats you have. I mean, are you seeing your members digging into their savings account just to get through this tough time? Does that sort of go without saying that you've been able to notice that kind of increase in withdrawals?
There hasn't been as much decrease of savings because, unfortunately, a lot of members don't have that savings built up that they should. Mm. So a lot of it is really just trying to help them with the loans that they need extensions so that they don't have to pay those. That's been a huge, huge thing. We don't want anything to go onto any members' long-term credit reporting records. So for us to be able to kind of modify their loans with the credit union to avoid any long-term detriment to their credit reports has been a huge thing.
In terms of some of the hardship situations you've stumbled across, can you talk just in generalities here about some of the kinds of situations some of these folks find themselves in?
We have a lot of members that are exactly like we are. They have good paying jobs. They live in all of our neighborhoods. I mean, it's not kind of that stereotypical grouping that you would think would be impacted by this. We have a lot of members that either a single paying household or a single parent that may not have had a strong financial footing because of a previous medical or financial situation. Mm-hmm. So they just don't have anything to draw from when these times happen. And
we hear about that, you know, those kinds of statistics all the time. And now you're seeing it actually play out in front of you. This need for people maybe to bank some savings for tough times down the road, these things do pop up.
Absolutely. I know that a lot of people are intimidated by banks in general.
Yeah.
They don't often see them as an arm or an extension of assistance during times that people may go
through. How do you deal
with
that?
Again, just situations like this, to where we can get the word out that credit unions are founded specifically to help people. And that is not just during good times or good credit. About 43% of the members that that we have extended these loans to have credit ratings of 50 or 599 or less, meaning they don't have the opportunity to go to a traditional bank or get any other financing. So it really is just kind of that increasing awareness of what credit unions are and how we're here to help and how we're here to partner with other community partners during times like this.
I'm also just guessing that the number of phone calls that Mazuma is getting right now must be a lot higher than what it typically might be.
It has been. And we have had very long wait times. We've had a lot of calls flooding our call center. And
part of that also has to do with our team members working situation by situation with every single one of our members. So it has been a lot longer conversations, higher call volumes coming in, but these are exactly the situations that we're here to help.
You know, again, we talk about this government shutdown as in sort of abstract terms. We talk about it as a political fight between the president and Congress and all these other things. But what we're talking about here are the real everyday impacts mm-hmm. of what this shutdown means to folks who live right here in our community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. We've funded about $360,000 out in about $1,400 average loan amounts.
Wow.
And we're kind of on standby to see if we need to do another round. We've done two rounds for our members that have reached out to us with that need. And we're building out a financial literacy program a little bit more specific to these types of situations so that we can kind of start providing value in other ways moving forward.
Well, if federal workers are listening right now, we'd like to hear their stories. How have you been affected by the shutdown? Give us a shout. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Again, 816-235-2888. Sarah, let's come back to you. How does Harvesters manage to calculate how much extra food to provide and where to distribute it when a crisis occurs like this one?
Well, a lot of it is kind of guesswork. Like I said, we reached out to people at the IRS, at some of these federal unions and our partners at GEHA and anybody we thought that might have some inside information about who was struggling, where they were located and that kind of thing. So that took us a few days to get that kind of figured out and then figure out distribution areas that we could pop up at basically a few days' notice and get that out there. And then, of course, we had no idea how many people were going to show up last night. Was it going to be 10 people? Was it going to be 200 people?
And how many was it?
We served 200 households last night with an average of 3.7 people in each one. So about 730 people received food for at the distribution last night.
And how did that work? I mean, describe the scene last night. Was it people pulling up in cars and just getting a donation? Or how did it play out?
So we pull our semi-truck into the parking lot and unload pallets of food. We had a variety of different non-perishable as well as perishable items that we were distributing. We had volunteers that were helping do that. And then people would come in their cars, line up, and then go through kind of like an assembly line and be handed the different items as they went by.
Would they get out of their cars and actually go from pallet to pallet?
They did not get out of their cars because of the weather. We had originally intended it to be where they could park and get out and have more of a client choice situation where they could choose exactly what they wanted. But because of the weather, we thought it would be better to just have them drive through, and the volunteers offered them the food as they drove by.
And did you basically offer them anything they might need for meals for the next few days or for a week, or how long was the offer here?
Yes, so we had a variety of different items. We had cans of beef stew, we had pasta, we had red sauce, we had applesauce, oatmeal, eggs, milk, we had some frozen meat, chicken, hamburger. A lot of it was, you know, what we had on hand based on donations. Some of it we did purchase so that we were able to provide for this immediate need. And then we had financial support from GEHA, which helped us be able to provide this food at a moment's notice and to do that 5 days in a row.
I was going to say, did you have a backlog of food that you were able to distribute here? Or when something like this pops up, how does Harvesters handle it?
We do have about a month's worth of food stored in our warehouse at any given time, but that's going out bit by bit on a daily basis. So if we stopped collecting food today, then in a month we would have no food. So, wow. You know, it's a constant juggling act and meeting our agencies. We have 760 agencies that we supply food to on a regular.
760 agencies.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Which means, what does that mean? What kind of agency?
So food pantries that you might see in a church or a community center are some of them. Food kitchens that serve hot meals, lunch meals and dinner meals. Shelters for children and women, homeless shelters across a 26-county area. A lot of people don't realize that we actually serve a 26-county area of northwest Missouri and northeast Kansas.
Yeah, people forget. You think that you're just Kansas City
right.
or something, right?
Right.
Or the central city or something like that. So Have donations increased to sort of help you compensate for what's going on here?
We are starting to see additional donations, which is helpful because we certainly can't do anything that we do on a regular basis, let alone meet additional demand without help from the community. And fortunately, Kansas City and the surrounding area is always willing to step up and help in these situations. So people have been donating food. They've been donating time because we have to have these volunteers to sort and repackage the food and then help at these distributions. And then, of course, money. Every dollar donated helps us provide three meals.
How well equipped is Harvesters to respond and go out to temporary sites and sort of take Harvesters on a mobile basis? Are you set up to do that?
Yes, we actually do mobile distributions, about more than 200 of them every month. In addition to the brick and mortar pantries where we are delivering food on a regular basis, we take our tractor trailer trucks out to various sites and in partnership with different organizations do these mobile distributions. So we are prepared to do that. We're also a disaster relief organization through Feeding America. So when, you know, the tornado hit in Joplin and other natural disasters happen, even when hurricanes are hitting other parts of the country, we're sending trucks and staff and food to assist.
You know, Marcy Nielsen, again, with the Government Employees Health Association, GEHA. You know, we know that health insurance doesn't necessarily cover every expense and there are deductibles. Do you have any sense of whether providers right now were showing a willingness to wait on bill payments without penalty for government workers out there?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that because we have been barraged in the media about this shutdown, that right. providers recognize that this is happening and probably on a case-by-case basis are working with federal employees, but I don't have any specific data.
I know you mentioned your organization took some special steps when it came to dental coverage. What did you do there, Marcy?
Well, the way in which funding works for through the Office of Personnel Management. If you're a federal employee, your funding doesn't come through the appropriations process. So that's in part why we can continue to provide medical coverage. But the federal dental insurance does come through an appropriation process. So we were just beginning to work with OPM to come up with a process that wouldn't direct bill our members who had dental insurance but no way to pay for it.
Yeah.
So we are hopeful that there won't be another shutdown. But in the event that there is, I think everybody certainly here today is talking about ways in which we can plan and have a contingency in the event that it happens again.
You know, is the takeaway from all this simply that government shutdowns are just bad on regular people? Is that what we're talking about here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just bad news, right?
Right. I mean, anytime you have people going without a paycheck, it's not good.
Not good. Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Marcy Nielsen, who oversees government affairs for GEHA, the Government Employees Health Association, Sarah Biles with Harvesters, and Dion Christensen with the Mizuma Credit Union. Thanks for all the good things you're doing to help folks out there. Sure appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Yesterday in the show, the candidate who says he's okay with taking the underdog positions, that's Henry Klein, told us what his priorities would be if he became Kansas City's next mayor. Find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.